Welcome to Chasing Sound, episode 46. This is Kirk.
I'm Andrew.
And I am Mohadev.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Just real quick, you just said your name, which is wonderful. That's a great start. But tell us, what projects are you currently involved in musically?
I'm involved in a lot of projects, but how about the ones that I'm like the driving force?
Yeah.
So I have a group called Stop Motion Orchestra, which plays mostly my compositions. It's an instrumental six-piece.
Mm-hmm.
Guitar, bass, drums, violin, saxophone, and synthesizer / cello.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Do you play your lead guitar, or do you do any vocals for this band?
It's instrumental, although Lila Henley, the saxophonist, does a little bit of vocals here and there, wordless vocals here and there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I don't know if that's still technically instrumental.
Yeah.
But it's not words.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all written out. There's not a lot of lead guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all composed and
if you had to compare it to something, what would you compare it to musically? Any other project out there that even comes close?
It's very much inspired by 70s prog rock.
Okay.
But a little bit more on the like rock and opposition side. If you know anything about that.
No.
But I usually tell people that if they've heard like Frank Zappa's instrumental music, it's kind of in the same universe as that.
Well, I mean, I like, you know, the prog bands that everyone's heard of from the 70s. I like all of those. Like, I like Can a good bit.
Yeah.
So, you say it's a little bit more Can, American flavor?
Can is really jammy, and this is really composed.
So okay.
It's not my... I love Can, but...
Yeah.
But this music is not like that.
Mm-hmm.
Some
more like, I don't know, maybe
more like
King
the
Crimson I don't know.
I think the instrumental Zappa is probably
instrumental
the closest
Zappa,
to
yeah, sure.
Because it's got a playfulness to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like dark and brooding or
anything. No, yeah, like King that. Crimson is pretty dark and pretty heavy. And this we get heavy a little bit, but it mostly tends to be a little bit more playful and upbeat.
Yeah, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, I listened to that a bit, and I would totally agree with that. Assessment. Yeah.
Zappa's is the most playful, and it's not at all druggy. You know, there's like no drug trippiness to Zappa to me. It's like, you know, satire, and it's all very, very sharp wit to me.
Yeah.
And the music is that too. Like, even without his words,
it's killer. Like really, but it's also really optimistic. It's got like a, which is kind of weird because he had a kind of
a brooding, cigarettes, chain smoking dude,
Whenever he wrote music, it was just super happy.
Well, yeah, like if you think of like Peaches and Regalia or some of that stuff, you know, it's just very like, because his original, you know, plan in life was to become a modern composer, you know. Classical composer.
Before the job title just disappeared.
His childhood, you know, hero was Pierre Boulez, so, you know, who...
Did you guys ever check out those orchestra albums he did with, like, the London Symphony Orchestra?
I haven't gotten around to really seriously
never got around to those.
This, but...
It's been a while.
I remember when I was a little kid seeing him talk about those records on Letterman. Like, Letterman was the only guy who would just have him on to promote his London Symphony Orchestra release, you know, like what other talk show would let Frank Zappa come on and talk about that. But yeah. He printed an apology on one of those records saying this, like, I could not afford to rehearse this orchestra as much as I needed them to. So there are mistakes that this is not a money project. I did as best I could. And it seems so funny because you know those mistakes are probably so small and that he probably probably drove him nuts that they were on there, but he just couldn't pay the tab to keep rehearsing the London Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah, I think that's like there's a struggle with being a perfectionist and not being able to clone yourself a bunch.
Just even trying to be a composer in the age of pop, you know?
Or in the age of machine
sheet
music.
Isn't selling anymore.
Because that's what he ultimately, you know, moved to was, you know, making everything on... early MIDI type machines.
Yeah, the Synclavier.
He loved sampling. Like,
I like that stuff too, especially Jazz from Hell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's. We want to build your musical timeline, so let's start on that. We could talk for Zappa for a long ass time. So take us back to childhood, and if you can summon it, tell us the first song that ever touched you in an emotional way. Like the first song where you're like, oh shit, this is a thing. This music thing is a thing.
Oh, wow. That's a... I don't think I could do anything like that. So I'll have to go a little bit further back. And, I grew up... My dad plays Indian classical music.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just around that music all the time when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
He was a student of Ali Akbar Khan's.
Okay.
And we used to spend the summers at his school of music in California.
Right. Wow.
So I was just around that music. So I was just around music from the time. Oh, I started playing. He started teaching me how to play his instrument, the sarod, when I was 4. And so I don't remember, like, for you know, the first song I heard
was not the same. We've had several guests who are like this. It's like their upbringing, Rajmani, where, like, their upbringing was different than it was, like, they heard, you know, Michael Jackson on the radio. It's like you just jumped right into this deep culture of music. So I imagine that's probably the first thing that touched you was your dad's playing, right?
I don't remember. It was just, like, kind of omnipresent, so mm-hmm. I don't remember, like...
You're hearing it in the womb,
like,
probably.
Hearing something for the first time. I think I remember, like, hearing... I actually do remember my older sister playing, when no one was home, like, putting on a Michael Jackson record.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was more, like... That's a different... It's not a memory, like, whoa, I heard Michael Jackson for the first time. It was more like... like, just a weird childhood thing, where my sister was sneaking on a... some different music when no one was
yeah.
home. But I can say, so then fast forward a little bit, I played music, I played sarod from the time, he taught me a little, I mean, I couldn't really play, but, and then I took violin lessons when I was like 6 on, and then I took piano lessons for a few years from the time I was 8,
mm-hmm.
and then I was in like band in junior high, I played mm-hmm. trombone.
Yeah.
But the first time I wanted to play music was after I heard Megadeth. I heard like
nice.
Marty
Which
Friedman
one?
Playing in Megadeth. It was probably
the Peace Sells intro.
No, it was after that. Later,
Symphony of
like Rust in
era?
Peace. Or, yeah. Actually, that was it. The Countdown to Extinction.
Yeah, that had some good tracks on it. High speed dirt. I like that one a lot.
I liked it at the time.
Yeah,
I don't go back to it anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I can listen to Rust in Peace.
Those first like couple, I can still listen to definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not the one with the hits though. Like I don't go back to that one.
I tried listening to it, and it was, like, kind of...
What was on there again? It was, like...
It has Symphony of Destruction, High Speed Dirt...
Foreclosure of a Dream.
Foreclosure of a Dream. Actually, that was one of the ones that I felt like still stood up.
Is it all, okay.
Still stood the test of time.
I don't think I've heard that since I had it on, like, cassette tape. It's so funny.
Oh, and there was that other one. There was a cool video for that song that's like, hello, me, it's
Meet
me.
The real me.
Yeah. And there's a video where they're all in the insane
What's
song.
The name of that one?
Sweating Bullets.
Sweating Bullets! That is awesome.
I'm sorry, Andrew, you're not a metal guy.
It's funny.
I'm a Metallica guy, but... And I like
Pantera,
and I like...
Metallica crossed all boundaries. Like, people who don't even like metal...
I like
metal,
prog
like,
metal. Like, I like, you know, Dream Theater and stuff like that. But I don't... I was a little too young to really get into Megadeth and, like, Slayer.
I graduated
in
95,
stuff.
And you were what? 99?
I graduated in 99. Well, and, like, also just...
So I'm in between you guys. I would have been 97.
Okay.
Once I got to high school, though, I kind of started to catch up because a lot of my friends were deep mm-hmm. into that stuff, and they kind of caught me up. Because, my parents also just... I don't know if I just wasn't into it. I don't think I ever, like, tested them, but I have a feeling they weren't, like... They wouldn't have been super excited about me bringing home, like... Megadeth records, anything like with
I had to hide that
subversive too, stuff on it like that probably wouldn't work. I remember I got like a friend of mine bought me some Guns N' Roses records, and I remember them like kind of looking at them like askance, you know, like you know, like
Roses
not sure
right.
if we're gonna keep that around. You better, you know, be careful with that, buddy. You know, kind of thing.
I was obsessed.
But anyway,
my band was my gateway drug.
But metal. Was pretty, you know, like, technically brilliant stuff for the most part, right? Like, or at least, like, lots of notes, right? So, like, you know,
yeah.
I think that was, like, kind of one of the things that made it more interesting than a lot of other pop mm-hmm. music out there musically was that it, like, I mean, like I said, I was a big Metallica fan. I think a lot of those Metallica songs are actually pretty interesting music. Like, they actually
Definitely.
Go somewhere. They have
yeah.
some changes. You know, it sounds like you actually have to think about what you're doing to play them instead of, like...
Oh, especially Injustice
you know,
for All. Like,
yeah.
the changes on that album are insane. Just, like,
Yeah.
So one of them, I think, has something crazy, like 60 different time signatures. Just something crazy. Like, that album broke all sorts of records for a complicated metal, and then that was sort of it. They went to a more contemporary structure after that. So, but let's do your timeline there. So what's the first thing you bought with your own money? Like, the first CD or whatever you bought with your own money?
It was probably like a Megadeth cassette or something.
Okay.
And then also just whatever was, that wasn't like, metal was kind of on its way out. That was like the last gasp, I guess. But I quickly got into the, like, a little bit older metal. So when, in the grunge era, I was listening to a lot of 80s stuff like Slayer and King Diamond stuff.
Yeah.
And Voivod. But then I also got, like, at the time there was, like, death metal was a really big deal, and I got really into death metal for a little while.
What were your bands in the death metal genre?
My favorite band was Morbid Angel, which is, like, one of the biggest ones.
They were great. What about the band Death? Did you ever hear of them?
Yeah, I mean, I still listen to Death pretty regularly.
Great band from Florida. Probably one of the most technically brilliant metal bands of all time, of any genre of metal.
Yeah, they, I think I had... You know, among the first like 20 albums I ever bought was Death's Individual Thought Patterns, which had King Diamond's guitarist Andy LaRocque on it.
It's interesting you mentioned King Diamond. I was thinking about doing a whole bonus episode about the genesis and birth and the whole thing of black metal, like taking it back to Merciful Fate and Venom, and then taking it into like Bathory and just showing how it, till it got to the Norwegian wave basically, and all the
the big press and stuff. I like all that stuff. Yeah. King Diamond was a huge deal for me.
Like, what a great stage show, and killer guitars too. I like Merciful Fate and the King Diamond solo stuff. Yeah, it's all pretty good.
Yeah, well, Merciful Fate was just like evil.
And those first two Venom albums.
When did you start playing guitar?
So I started playing, after I had played all these other instruments, then I got into metal.
Yeah.
I heard Megadeth and I was excited about it. And then I had a friend when I was like 14 or 15 and he had a guitar, and I picked up his guitar and I was able to like figure out how to play like what Enter Sandman or something within like a minute or something. And so I can do this. Yeah.
That's cool.
So I had the moment where like it felt right immediately when I picked up a guitar.
Sure.
So.
Well, how long did you play Sarod?
That was just for, I don't remember, but it wasn't for too long.
Okay.
But you did violin and piano.
And then I did violin and piano. Yeah. So I had I had a...
Certainly like had the ear, I'm sure, at that point.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I had, so I had a ear.
Because I was going to say, like, you listen to all this stuff and it's all, you know, guitar driven, you know, like, you bands, you know, like,
guitar is
always going to be the
seductive for a young man. Like, it's just the cool thing. Like, the guitar player looks cool in videos, it sounds cool, you know.
If
you can't sing and you're too shy to like be that guy, it's the next best thing, you know. People look at the lead guitar player.
So, and then, you're listening to some pretty subversive. Rock here. I'd say most people would classify it as such. How were your parents reacting to that?
So when I was younger, I think they would have been weird about it. I grew up with my dad, but I think by this time he didn't really care.
Yeah.
Were you guys living in Texas and then just going to California for the school? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I think that was when I was younger, but by this point, I don't remember. We might have gone a couple times when I was a teenager, but yeah.
Were you based in Austin? Or?
In College Station, Texas.
College Station. Okay, that's right. Kanye was saying that. Your friends with my roommate. So, College Station. I have a couple of cousins that lived out there. That's very cool.
Yeah.
So, what was that like growing up? It's kind of smallish.
It's kind of a horrible place.
Is it?
Yeah. Actually, yeah. I hear it's getting better now, but it wasn't very fun being me growing up there, you know.
Was there a lot of active racism there?
I don't know how, like,
overt it was. I've heard it's not too fun to be black there.
That's what I've heard. Yeah, it's like a really conservative place. I don't know, you know, I've lived in Austin for a while, and I've been, I've traveled around the world a little bit, but, like, there's, like, I can just feel, like, an oppressive air in College Station. People stare at me.
It's a tone, yeah.
When I'm walking around. And so I don't remember that from when I was a kid, but I know it's there now, and it must have been there when I was a kid. So even if I wasn't aware of it, it's like a psychic stressor, I think.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think that's partly why I got so into metal and, like, really evil stuff, because that was, like, the first thing I found that was, like, totally against the environment I was in.
Right.
So,
It's kind of like give you a something to like be strong with, you know.
Especially Megadeth was like the
flip the finger, you know, with that sort of stuff.
Megadeth had those lyrics that were so kind of against like the society that's controlling young people, mm-hmm. or just like very much against, disenchanted with the politics of the day.
Yeah.
And yeah, exactly. That's what metal's good for, man. So let's take it up to when you first started to play guitar with other people, like in a band.
So the first time I started playing, I mean, I used to jam with people in, with different people in high school, but it wasn't until like just after I dropped out of high school, and then I met...
Hardcore, man. What year did you drop out?
yeah, right?
Pretty badass.
Yeah.
I just didn't fit in there, and I was, you know... troubled teenager. So I dropped out of high school in, I don't know, 95 or 96, a year or so before I would have graduated and got my GED. But then I started playing. I met this guy, David Beck, who I still play with sometimes. He's a really amazing drummer. He also, I mean, he grew up in a small town in Palestine, Texas. Mm-hmm. Palestine, I think.
When you first started playing with him, was that in College Station?
Yeah, that was. Okay. I met him when I was like 17, and we started the first band I was ever like real band I was in was a death metal band.
What were they called?
Pylon the 11th.
Nice.
It was like some Egyptian, ancient Egyptian goddess that eats corpses off the earth or something.
It sounds
like that.
Dead on. Yeah, it's a great metal name.
It was
sounds pretty hard.
So was it just the two of you, or did you guys scare up a bass
player? It
was
the two of us. We never found a bass player. It was us and another guitar player, mm-hmm. and then this vocalist guy, death metal vocalist.
Yeah,
it was pretty cool.
Did you guys go drop D or just standard?
No, yeah, I never. It was all standard tuning. The other guitarist might have done some stuff in drop D. We did a lot of like harmonized guitar parts. I recorded us on my 4-track at the time, but I lost the tape at some point. And I don't know. No. I actually have my mini. I had a mini disc Sony 4-track recorder, and I have the mini discs. But I gave away the 4-track to someone when I was moving at some point. So I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to like try to go back and find that. But I had done a decent recording of Pylon the 11th. It would be awesome to find it.
Was it how were the vocals and everything? Was it pretty decent?
Yeah, we had a really great vocalist. He was an older guy.
Nice.
And we played, you know, we played in College Station. We played at like Double Dave's Pizza or whatever.
Oh right, love that place. What were you guys listening to as a band? Were you guys getting into the? I know it was for people who like heavy music, the '90s was a great time because while you know metal was not having quite the same payday that they were in the '80s, there was a lot of interesting stuff coming out of the West. They're like the Caius. Soundgarden, you know, just like a lot of a different kind of heavy. The Melvins was catching on a lot when I was
Sugar.
Were you guys into that at all, or were you pretty straightforward?
My bandmates were probably a little more into that kind of stuff. I mean, I liked Soundgarden. I remember being into Soundgarden in high school, but for me, by this time, it was more like straight up death metal and then a lot of '80s stuff.
Cool.
I was kind of like always out of time with my. I was like listening to music from 1986.
In junior high, I was obsessed with the first four Aerosmith albums to the point like I probably needed therapy for how much I listened to those. And none of my friends related to it. Like, they're like, I like Love in an Elevator. I'm like, that's fucking bullshit. You need to listen to these. it's weird sort of being out of pocket with your generation, even for just like a couple of years, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's more like an attitude. I mean, it's hard to tell exactly what was going on, but I think
so
part
much
of it,
testosterone,
I was just like, I'm just against whatever everyone else is doing.
Or you're stupid. You can't believe you don't like, that's how I felt. Like I felt sorry for other people.
That didn't like Aerosmith.
That didn't like those first four albums specifically. Yeah. Yet somehow liked like Permanent Vacation and Pump. It's like, you're fucking stupid. Or they liked Metallica Black Album and none of the first ones. That shit drove me crazy. Probably because I was raging with
Of course, that's because like that's when the bands finally figure out how to make it mainstream. And they, you know. And then, of course, everybody likes them. And then you're like, you know, the angry nerd who like, I was here first.
With your inhaler.
You know, like that's the typical like hipster pose right there. Yeah. Like, oh my God, you're just getting to this? So
when did you get the hell up out of College Station? When did you move out of there?
I moved out, like, it took me a little while. I think I was like 21 or so when I finally moved, which was kind of late, you know, because, actually, that's not too, let's see. I moved a few times. I moved off. I went to, like, I got into UNT when I was, like, 20. Uh-huh. I didn't stay there. And then I lived in Massachusetts. I moved around a little bit for not no real interesting reasons. And then somehow I ended up in Austin.
Yeah.
And when I ended up in Austin, so I also started listening to a lot of, like, progressive rock in high school and other music. I started listening to some, like, 20th century composers. Mm-hmm. But progressive rock was one that my older sister had loaned me, like, a Yes tape, and I listened to that.
Do you remember which one? Over,
I think it was a comp. I think it was called Classic Yes, and it was like a
Peter Gabriel
compilation
year or so. I mean, not Peter Gabriel. What's the front? That's Genesis. Who was the front man for Yes?
John Anderson.
Yeah, yeah.
They only made until recently. They only made one album without John Anderson, and that was in the early '80s. Drama. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's cool. So Yes was your gateway drug into Prague?
Yeah, and I think when I moved to Austin, I used to go to the record stores, and at this time, you know, around 2001, 2002 or something, records were, like, not cool at all. Mm-hmm. So I bought a record player.
They're cheap, yeah.
Yeah, you could go to the record, Antones or whatever, and just, like, buy all these Prague
sound
albums
exchange
for, like, 50 cents or a dollar. Mm-hmm. So I would buy all these Gentle Giant albums and, like, King Crimson and Yes.
Dude, I got a Bruce Springsteen, like, live box set, 5 LPs at Sound Exchange for, like, $4. Like, you're exactly right. That time right before it became super hip again to get vinyl, that was the cheapest way to just, like, fatten up your collection.
Yeah, you could buy tons. It was awesome. Yeah. I mean, I bought a record player for that exact purpose. I was like, there's all these prog albums, and they're super cheap. Stuff that, you know, that this was, you couldn't just, like, digitally stream everything at this time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that I bought a bunch of stuff. Although, I didn't get into the, like, more obscure stuff until a few years later. But it was fun. It was hard to find a record player because most people didn't make record players. So
I don't know if you guys remember. You grew up in Texas, that store Conn's appliance store.
Yeah, I think
Texas
I remember
thing.
That.
Yeah, my stepdad worked there, and I hit him up. It was probably around the same time you were getting. It was sometime in the '90s, and I was like, "Can you find me a record player?" And he checked, like, every store in all of Houston and all the annexes of Houston, and he found one. It had been a return that somebody had sent back. And it was, you know, one of those, like, it was like a stereo built in, couple of cassette things, and then a record player on top.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And that fucking worked, man. And I did just like you. I was such an audiophile, and my minimum wage job didn't pay enough. So I did that. I started buying used records just to broaden my palate, or, like, to get stuff that I wouldn't have the guts to spend $16 on a CD.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it wouldn't mean as much. Yeah, that's awesome that you did that. That's like, that was a magic little time before.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I'd have collected records, because then they would have gotten stolen out of my car, like, two or three times.
Yeah,
I lost my CD collection on multiple occasions.
It's funny, but we don't have to worry about that shit at all now. Like, everything you ever wanted to listen to is, like, a click of a button. It will fly through the air into your phone.
Yeah. I don't really do much of that. I've been using Spotify a little bit lately, but mostly I listen to CDs and records and tapes still.
Yeah. Well, the sound quality is still way better for the analog stuff, so.
Definitely.
So right on. So you moved when you were in Austin. You moved here like 2001. You said
around then. Am I 2001, 2002.
What sort of scene were you getting into in Austin?
I was here at that time. Like, what did you land into? Did you have buddies here and stuff?
No, I didn't. And I was trying to. I was like, I'm gonna be in Austin. It's gonna be awesome. I'll be able to, like, start this amazing band. Actually, so now I have a. I remember putting this Craigslist ad up around that time. It might have been a little 2003 or 2004. Mm-hmm. And I just had listed all these obscure bands I was getting into. And by, I think 2004 was when I first heard Cardiacs, which was a life-changing one for me, hearing the band Cardiacs. So I had put this Craigslist ad, and it was like, I'm into Henry Cow, Emperor, Cardiacs, like, Anthony Braxton or something. And I was like, I want to start a band. And I was like, I'm going to get these, you know, some weirdos in Austin. Of course, I got no responses.
Yeah.
There was like one death metal guy contacted me, and he was like, I don't know. I don't think he understood my... We didn't really see eye to eye. So nothing came of it. And I didn't know that there was any interesting music going on in Austin at all. I was like, just like completely removed from any scene or any kind. I didn't know where the... I didn't know how to find any of that stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then I met I met this guy named Nathan James, who's a really fantastic guitar player. I met him on a prog rock discussion forum, and he was into Cardiacs and some of the weirder prog I was getting into, and he lived in Austin. So
cool.
Then we started hanging out, and he invited me to some shows, and then I started realizing that there was people playing, you know, at least some creative rock music in Austin at that time.
You got your in, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
So when
then I moved, so I didn't really get involved.
Wait, what? you left again?
Yeah, yeah, right when I met just, you know, a handful of musicians, yeah. People I'm still friends with today, like Josh Robbins, uh-huh. and Sam Arnold. I met them, and they were having, you know, playing interesting music. Opposite Day was just starting out,
mm-hmm.
and Invincible Czars were, I think, still pretty young at the time.
Yeah.
I was in a relationship, and we decided to move to Tucson for her to get her PhD.
Okay.
So I ended up moving to Arizona for like 4 or 5 years,
Tucson's a cool town. Did you play music while you were there?
Yeah. So Tucson, when I got to Tucson, I was like, I got to work trying to find, doing the same shit, putting these weird,
OICC rules.
Yeah. I got to work.
Say all the words.
I don't normally cuss a lot, but I just slipped out. I got to work in Tucson trying to do this, like, put together some weirdo band.
You've been hanging around Kurt too much. He's a potty man.
I am.
But I didn't have any luck there either. Mm-hmm. But at some point I met a few people, and then I started doing this thing where I started like kind of pushing the thing in the band in the direction I wanted to go.
Uh-huh.
Since they weren't listening to the same music as me, so we couldn't find common ground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I would be like, you just play this part, and I'll play this. And then slowly that evolved into like starting to write out the parts,
mm-hmm.
and then it ended up being like everything was written out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started finding people that had grown up playing in band and stuff that were like, you know, playing more traditional instruments, not rock instruments, that didn't have anything to do with, like, you know, you play right. a band your whole life,
and then
as an adult, no one cares that you play tuba.
Yeah, exactly, or any of it.
But you
yeah.
can still read and still play.
Yeah, you can still read, you can still play. And so I started, you know, getting those people to play. I would write out the music, and then I had a band called Calle de Boche, which no one could ever pronounce our name right because it was a stupid name.
Yeah.
It's like Spanish and French words together for no reason.
I like it.
And it had it was drums, tuba instead of bass, a marimba player, uh-huh. a saxophone player,
that is awesome.
And then me on guitar. And
who's it? The band had a track on, you know, one of their famous albums, like Music for Big Pink or something, where they had tuba in place of the bass.
Oh,
just
yeah.
on one song, but it's like, man, it was memorable.
Yeah.
That's cool. It's a cool substitute, and it totally works.
Yeah.
It hits that same zone.
It worked great live. I recorded an album of ours, and I didn't know what I was doing recording. Mm-hmm. Like, I recorded it with all 57s. Like, there's just 57s on all the drums, and 57s on the guitar, 57s
yeah.
on the tuba. the tuba, I wasn't able to capture the low end of the tuba.
How
as
did
well.
You? Yeah, it's still, like a ribbon.
It still sounds all right. I'm pretty proud of that album.
So, how were you guys miking that tuba live? What was that like?
It would just be, yeah, he would put it like at an angle. The tuba player had some idea. And then eventually, I think he bought his own like ribbon mic or something.
Okay, right on.
Which worked better.
Way better low end, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So you're in Tucson for a couple of years. Yeah, Tucson was a very cool arty town.
Yeah.
Is it a university town? Is that the
yeah.
deal?
Yeah, and I went to college when I was there, a little bit late in life. But
uh-huh.
And got
What's the university
degree.
Is there?
University of Arizona.
Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, I've had several friends over the years leave Austin to go there to go to school. Like,
yeah.
it's kind of a... It's not like a super common path, but it comes up frequently enough that it's like, I guess that's just a thing. People look at their options and they're like, well, Tucson is like Austin in the 80s.
Yeah.
So why don't
that's
I just go
the,
there?
You know, that's kind of how I imagine it is like, this must be what Austin was like,
mm-hmm.
you know, long before.
People say
time.
That. It's like, if you want to see like Austin 85, just go to Tucson.
Well, I don't know if you could still do that, but yeah, I was
yeah.
there because I was there on tour in like 2006 or 7.
So that was when I was there. Who were you playing with?
Death Is Not Joyride. When I was playing with that band, and I...
They were a cool art rock band.
Yeah, and we played, I don't know what the strip was. It was like this place that was like half restaurant, half performance venue.
There was Club Congress, I remember that place.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was just like super, like, I just remember like, you know, the vibe was super cool, because like we played for a while, And after we got done with the show, like, we hung out in the bar, and then, like, just people were just hanging out in the street. Like, mm-hmm. it was just, like, a happening in the street.
Yeah.
You know, just all these people hanging out, and...
Wait, were you playing at Club Congress, or...
No, that was just the one club I remember from...
I can't even remember. Now, it was, like, I don't know. The only other thing I can remember about it was that it kind of had, like... It was, like, two shotgun rooms right next to each other with big plate glass windows looking out onto whatever street we were on. It was clearly, like, those streets.
It sounds
street.
Like maybe Plush.
Yeah, Plush. That sounds yeah. right.
I played there a good bit.
They were really nice to us. It was super cool.
Were you guys received okay in Tucson? Like, at your gigs with the, you know, with your unique instrumentation set up? Like,
we,
with the tuba?
No.
Okay.
We did, I mean, it was all right. There were people would come see us play. We would, I mean, there was no scene, like, remotely, you know, Tucson has this kind of, like, desert rock music vibe. I don't know. Calexico
yeah.
is there.
Calexico,
and
yeah.
there's these kind of, like,
there's been a few
deep
big...
voiced singer-songwriter mm-hmm. people that sing about being cowboys or whatever.
Do-rag.
So I'm playing this really happy, like, Zappa-inspired yeah. music that... with weird instruments, and it's all instrumental. And
well, I mean, I've been told by my friends that like, kind of grew up in Tucson that you, like, couldn't give live music away there. Like, it's kind of hard to get anyone excited about any performance there, to some extent.
I would say it was like that. There wasn't a ton of people that... I mean, it's like, you see the same people around at shows.
Mm-hmm.
So I played in another band there. I started a band with a friend of mine, Ben DeGain, who we still record together, actually, called Terraformation. And that's a little bit more, and like it, the music kind of matches the landscape of
right.
Tucson. It's kind of like jazzy post rock instrumental stuff. Mm-hmm. He plays vibraphone and drums.
Uh huh.
Yeah, we used to play at Plush, and Kaya DeBoche played at Club Congress one time because we opened for Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum.
Oh, right. Really
his band opened.
Yeah, we got to do that
oh, yeah?
too here in
what
Austin.
What a killer band,
so.
Man. I bet that
they
was
were,
a dream
they were like
for
my
guys.
Favorite
yeah.
active
yeah.
band at the time. So,
oh, my
yeah,
gosh.
It was awesome. I was too nervous. I think I didn't play very well. But
they're like a whole city rolling in. You know, they're
yeah,
just like,
yeah.
they are such
I mean,
a complete unit with like.
I watched their sound check, and their sound check blew me away because it was the most serious sound check I'd ever seen, where they had a like they had their own sound person, and one this guy was doing all these different sounds with his voice and then telling them to boost and lower different frequencies in the monitors, like,
yeah
they had a super thorough sound
yeah.
check.
They have to,
doing.
Man. All
yeah,
their,
and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. those guys
are hilarious because they looked like they were from
Mad Max, right?
Mad Max.
Straight off of Mad Max.
But they were all just like geniuses.
Okay, even yeah. the I saw one of their
very unassuming
their bass player had a side project, or one of them had a side project, and even that was killer. It was just him and a woman. Did you know
Fawn Fables?
Yeah,
Fawn Fables. Yeah,
and even that was like, man, this is breathtakingly
yeah,
good. This
yeah,
is so
really good.
Far above what anybody else with this setup could pull off.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, they were definitely like, if you didn't, I don't think we'll ever see them again. I think they're done. But
well, they have a new band with it's not everybody. The Carla, the
uh-huh.
violinist, and the old drummer are not in the band, but everyone else is.
Okay.
And with some other dudes, and it's they put out an album called Free Salamander Exhibit. I've been listening to it.
It's good.
It's good, yeah. It's been, if you like
uh-huh.
the last
Jeez,
Sleepy Time
that.
Album, Inglorious Times,
uh-huh.
it's kind of like that, which
uh-huh.
I felt like was a little bit more of. There's a lot of variety on it, so
mm-hmm.
some here and there
uh-huh.
kind of sounds like. A different, like almost like a compilation, but it's,
yeah.
but it's good. There's a lot of really good tunes on it.
Yeah, Fawn Fables is always a good show too. If you
yeah,
watch them,
really
because
good.
You know they do a lot with a little. You know they
mm-hmm.
they're you know
two great singers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two great singers.
Just
Niels
so
is
much
amazing,
emotion.
And that was the thing with Sleepy Time too. They had two great singers with Carla and Niels.
Yeah,
you know, and
it's such
and,
a. Just
and two great percussionists, you know, you got
and nobody
two
ever talks
killer...
about them. That's what kills me. Is
yeah.
like, that was one of the most interesting bands
and then
of
Niels,
all time.
Yeah, I know. And Niels and Carla were both, like, fabulous instrumentalists.
Yeah, and
they're, you know?
They were all just incredible performers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
no shame
were...
in their game.
Yeah.
But yeah, go check them out, guys.
So you, you came back to Austin after Tucson? Is that how that went, or did you go somewhere else?
I came back to Austin after Tucson.
Okay,
so,
when was that, and what was that like?
That was in 2009, I moved back here.
Did you break up with that girl? Or did you
yes.
Okay.
That's exactly what happened. Yeah. I broke up with that girl, and I was like, I'm going to go back to Austin. And my band, the band was kind of, the saxophone player had moved away. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, time to get out of Tucson.
Yeah.
And I came back to Austin, and then I got to work putting together the band that's now Stop Motion Orchestra. Because I started talking to the violinist, Alden Doyle.
Yeah.
Who's a friend. You know Alden?
I know Alden. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so me and him have been playing together since 2009. We put it together, a band called Ugly Numbers. And it was kind of a continuation of Calle de Boche, my Tucson band.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I would like to think that my compositions got a little bit more interesting.
Probably. Yeah. That, you know, people tend to evolve, yeah. I think that's a safe bet that they probably got more interesting.
And that's what evolved into Stop Motion Orchestra. Yeah. As you started to add other players and such.
We had a full band. It was called Ugly Numbers until 2014.
Okay.
And it was like, I had trouble, you know, getting my act together in all areas of life, but also in playing music. So we had all these songs and we had a full set and we would play these shows, but I was planning to record us. And I actually tried like 3 times to record us myself, and then also having another guy, a friend of mine, record us. Mm-hmm. And then every time it just like didn't make it to the end. Then 2014, I was like, yeah, I'm tired of doing this. Let's like get serious about it.
Yeah.
And so I got my act together enough to record our album and put it out.
Cool.
2013, maybe I started. Mm-hmm.
I know you're not too much into gear, but do you mind telling us what your current setup is? Which, like,
my recording setup or my gigs? Guitar stuff?
Yeah.
I use this Trainer, like recent, you know, 2000, mid-2000s Trainer, right. 112 combo amp. Mm-hmm.
Is it the one of the tube amps?
It's a YCR.
Trainer is
the
like
wine red one.
The best kept secret in amplification. They're like the Marshall of Canada, but they're like way less known. But if you talk to amp techs have like and ask them like what's the best type of amp that nobody talks about, they will always say Trainer.
I think probably like the classic the 60s
YB
or 70s
ones.
Or whatever.
Yeah, they said there was like a simple mod you could do to their classic YB series that made them into a Marshall, like a very easy mod. So I think a lot of road guys loved them for that. Mm-hmm. Huh. So you're playing that, and then what's your guitar about?
Guitar is a recent Tele. Okay. I played this like cheap Ibanez that I got when I was 19 until last year.
That's awesome, man.
Before we started, I was talking about like I had this kind of anti-gear attitude because mm-hmm. which was silly, but you know, I felt like people got too into gear, and I was kind of reacting to that by being like, I don't care at all about gear, which is admittedly kind of silly.
It is, but it probably helped you at the time. That seems like a useful tool. Like more people should probably go through that phase, you know.
Yeah.
People who are like, when you get into a room and jam with them, they just never get off the floor. They don't stop fucking with their pedals. That drives me insane.
Yeah. It's really annoying.
Pick a spot you like.
Yeah.
And let's hear you play, motherfucker. Like let's see your eye contact and you know.
Yeah, it's like the pedals and stuff are controlling
they
you.
They own
something.
You. Yeah. And then oh man, the people on Reddit. Like, you know, I love it too. I love looking at gear and stuff and reading about vintage pedals that do weird things. But man, some of these guys on Reddit, I swear they buy a new pedal, like a new $300 pedal every week just to put up on Reddit that they got a new pedal.
Well, that, you know, they've got gas.
Gear acquisition syndrome, Yeah, we were talking about the joy of getting a great tone through a cheap setup and having people.
Yeah.
I love bringing a PV Bandit to record or a gig, and people be like, "You're getting that out of a Bandit? I just hate you for that."
Well,
you know, because
that thing sounds fantastic with your setup.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I require 3 always on pedals to get that tone, but I feel like I could plug this thing into like a Marshall MG 10-watt, you know, student practice amp and get a pretty good tone. I would need a minute with the knobs, but
yeah,
that's the idea.
Well, and the real key is like, can you play?
Yes.
Like it's.
You cannot get around
it's like,
that.
What's going on the instrument?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything else is just icing, you know? Like, any good player can get
most
a good tone out of a decent instrument, you know, which is probably like, you know, like, that's the thing. Like, or like, think of like Jack White, you know, he, mm-hmm. You know, all of his recordings are on just like cheap guitars, but
really?
He's clearly a, and cheap, yeah, he kind of like, you know, he kind of had the, he acquires a lot of gear, but it's all like trash, cheap pawn shop stuff. Huh. And then he kind of messes with it, you know. Yeah. But he's clearly a great player. So, you know, like, you can get it, you know. I think it helps to have a nice setup and nice strings, you know, is really helpful.
That would be the bare minimum. Changing your strings would probably serve you better than any pedal you can buy. Just
really. That's what I always... I worked in a violin shop for many years. And, well, not many years, but a couple of years. And I... many years ago, and I what I learned there was that like an instrument is, you know, obviously the final tone is going to come from the instrument, but if you get like really good strings and brand new strings, it's going to make like a huge difference in the sound of an instrument. Like, you can have a pretty
on violin
for sure, and I think on guitar too.
I change my strings a lot, you know, that's, I pay too much for like buy these clear tone strings. They cost, they're like, you know, it's like $12 or $13 for a set, but I really do believe the best pedal or the best instrument is just a fresh set of good strings, like they, you know, and you just hear the difference when you change them, where you're like, just like, ah, it's so present. To me, it sounds like a horse biting into an apple. You're like, man, that's a sound right there. Like,
I think I know what you're talking about, but since I've been playing my telly, it's it's always so bright that I kind of like it when the strings get a little bit
Older. So it's like kind of... Telly is its own beast. I was a telly man for many years. Like, the sweep on the tone knob on a telly, like, once you've had that big of a sweep, it's hard to give it up. You can do that wah pedal trick where you just cock the tone knob all the way back and just roll it up real sharp, and it goes wah, wah. It's fucking awesome, and only the telly seems to have that sweep.
Yeah.
And, the tonal difference between bridge and neck pickup on the telly, like, I don't think any other instrument is that broad in tonal variations. I think that's why Radiohead guys still use tellies. Like, they're the best tool for the job. They hold tune like a motherfucker. Like, they never go out of tune.
Sure.
So that's cool. So you just straight up stock telly all the way, or did you mod?
Right now it's straight up. And I like it. It's good. I play some heavy stuff. Stop Motion Records isn't that heavy, but Gibber and Twitch is heavy, and I'm working. I have a new project in the works. It's a metal band, and it's fun playing just super heavy stuff on it. It sounds great. Like, you can get a really good,
you can go heavy metal on those things,
metal sound on a telly, and mine plays. It's got a really, like, the neck is a really modern neck, so you can play pretty fast on there.
They're
but it looks cool with a really pretty telly, and then I'm just playing this, like,
what color is the paint job?
I think it's called Autumn Haze or something. It's like a shiny red.
Nice.
Oh, okay.
Paint. Sparkly.
So, you compose for the Stop Motion Orchestra, maybe some of your other bands. Can you kind of talk about your process your process for doing that? How do you, you know, what do you use, like, notation software?
I do everything. So this is kind of interesting to me, that I've noticed that depending on what software I use to write, that has a huge impact in what the music ends up sounding like.
Uh-huh. That's weird, right?
Because I used to use like those more like composer softwares. I don't remember what the one I used.
Finale, maybe.
It was like a cheap knockoff of those it was that someone gave me. And so it had really cheesy sounds, so I couldn't really tell what it was going to sound like, you know, when actual instruments played it.
Yeah.
And the music came out different. It would sound like a video game in the MIDI.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, is this going to sound like a video game?
Right,
thing?
Right.
When people play it, I think back then people had a little bit more choices to make, because it didn't sound like any instruments. It just sounded like electronic sounds. So they have people
shitty
would,
MIDI. That's what it sounded like. Shitty it. MIDI.
But now I use Logic, and it sounds, I use those sounds in Logic that sound kind of like real instruments. I think some of them are actually samples, like the guitar sounds like a guitar, like kind of a one-dimensional guitar, but...
Sure, yeah.
So, yeah.
Robot
and
guitar.
I write out everything in there and then generate sheet music from that.
Well, do you think it's because of the process or the setup of the flow of how you enter stuff into it, or is it the sound that comes out when you play it back to you?
I think it's both of those things.
Yeah.
So I don't remember when I was writing with that old like notation software, it was a lot more difficult to, like in Logic I use piano roll, and I'm just like clicking and dragging the notes to be the right length and then listen to it and you know, copying and pasting stuff and then like changing the to do harmonies and stuff like that.
Yeah, okay.
With the old, with that software, it was a lot more, it was a lot trickier. And I think that made it, somehow made it sound, I can't tell you exactly how, but it was, it felt different and the music came out a little bit different.
Yeah, because I think that's definitely true when I, you know, because I didn't really start composing stuff much until I got to college, and then I was already using Sibelius. I've been using Sibelius like my whole life. So
these are just softwares for...
Well, Sibelius is a notation software, so it's basically like, you know, instead of pen and paper, you use Sibelius.
Yeah,
you know,
that's for people that know what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah, and certainly for, yeah, you have to obviously know how to write and read music to use Sibelius. But I always found that it did influence me for sure, because it was like, first of all, this kind of like a classical idea of composition that like you sit in a quiet place and the music comes to you, and then you write it down. Or when you have decided that is the music, then you write it down. It's kind of like it exists in your head for a while and you think about it and then you put it down. Whereas with like music notation software, you can almost kind of like go like
paint by numbers.
Well, that, and also you can kind of do free composition. You just kind of like, it's coming into my head, or I can play it in. I can just get on the piano and just start playing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it picks it up on the MIDI. And it had a very, you know, I think it's had a radical effect on it. The other thing, too, is because you can copy and paste stuff so easily.
Yeah.
You can repeat stuff, or you can make harmonies really quickly because you just boom, move it up
exactly.
A third or a sixth or whatever.
It's easy to try out different arrangements quickly. Just
exactly.
Moving parts around.
Oh, I can see how that would influence.
As opposed to, you know, the old-fashioned way would be, again, you'd have to, like, let me think about that and see if I can hear it in my head. Yeah. Or go work it out on the piano for a while, but...
Yeah.
You know, and so you,
I think you can still, sometimes, I don't tend to write, well, for when I'm writing for this new metal band, I'm writing with my guitar, obviously.
Yeah.
But with Logic, I never write with my guitar. In fact, I sometimes write stuff that I can't play because I, and then I won't realize it until I've sent out all the music and we're actually playing it, so it can get a little bit complicated because I'm purposely not writing with my guitar.
And then you're that guy. I always think that's funny when I go to a rehearsal and I'm reading music and like the composers, can't play some stuff, you know, and you're like, oh, come on, man. But I understand how that could happen if, you know,
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it can get pretty hard to play stuff that you write out without trying to play it first.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to, you know, be too judgmental, but it's just like, it's just kind of funny sometimes. It's like, oh, you know, like...
There was a guitar player that would write for Chet Atkins that would just, like, he couldn't remember his stuff, or he couldn't shred through his own stuff, but he could write it.
Right.
And Chet Atkins loved it. So, like, he would, you know, of course he would play the songs, but yeah, the guy would, he would be too nervous live to even, like, I don't even know if I can play that fast.
Yeah.
But he could get it down enough to show it to Chet Atkins, and that was the important thing.
But I was also going to say, like, that also, like, if you compose stuff, obviously, then you have to have a certain kind of class of musician that's going to come in and work in that band. So, do you find that was, I mean, obviously it's working. How is that? How did that work for Stop Motion Orchestra?
It took a while. So, you know, going back to 2009 when we started and it was called Ugly Numbers, we've been through tons of players over the years. And I think it took a while to get to where that we could get the people that were good enough to really do it, to be interested in it, I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe just meeting people and stuff like that. So right now it's a really amazing lineup.
Yeah.
Like, it's like the best people that I could imagine to play each part. But everybody in the band is really busy, so I try not to, like... So we don't play, you know, we don't play, like, every week or anything like that.
Right, right.
We do it when there's stuff to be done, we'll get together and rehearse and then play. But it's not like a... It's not the kind of... It's not like the 70s idea of a band where you all live together.
In a house.
And play the tunes every day and then rearrange them.
That get ridiculously tight.
Well, it's like the opposite of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's maybe where the notation helps out a lot. Because it's kind of like, we just come back and read it and do it, you know. Is there a... is there kind of like a push and pull between you and the players? Like, you know, you're putting music in front of them. Are they saying, eh, what if we did this? Is there like enough of that, or are they just kinda...
There's a little bit of that. I mean, sometimes people, I mean, and you know, there's always like some room for interpretation.
Sure.
But I think mostly the everybody in the band kind of, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I think they kind of respect me and they like the music, so...
Well, they want to play with it.
There's definitely never any kind of weird, like, tension or anything, I think. And, you know, if someone wants to make changes, I'm not like, you know, no, you shut up.
Yeah. Well,
this
so,
is how it goes.
Because yeah, that's the thing. It's this like, you bring up, like, bands in the 70s. We were talking about Zappa earlier, you know, so you think of, like, the,
oh, yeah,
the composer like the in Nazi. Rock... Yeah, being kind of like a, you know, a Nazi and kind of like a, well, and, you know, like, of course, like, Zappa, you know, you've seen the famous interview with him where he talks about how he's the referee between the audience and the band. Like, it's really good. He explains his position, like, why he kind of has to be a jerk sometimes is that because, you know, I'm fronting all of this money. It's my, you know, like, name and stuff that's on the line, so...
Yeah.
You know, and...
Well, you know, it might be a little different if there's, like, real money involved.
Yeah, exactly, right. Like, I'm sure Stop Motion Orchestra is not $1 million company or anything.
Not yet.
Not Let's yet. See. Not yet. We're working on it.
We're working on our second album.
So you said you've got a new metal band going?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What's the name of this band?
It's called Necrozoid.
Wonderful. Nice. Tell us a little bit about this band. What's the story?
It's I probably shouldn't say too much about it because it's like a very new thing, but it's going to be, I will say it's going to be really, really awesome. It's,
okay.
You know, because I got away from metal for a long time and got into other kinds of music, but it's really exciting for me to, I don't know, I feel like I'm like 16 again or something.
Yeah, right.
I've often fantasized about making another metal band.
You know, it's whatever you listen to, I think, when you're like, 15, 16, it's just kind of in your blood forever.
There's no getting rid of it. Definitely. So what pace? Are you going to do breakneck speed, or are you going to do a little bit more groove and stuff?
It's pretty fast so far. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be pretty aggressive.
Okay. Aggressive, shreddy.
What's the instrumentation setup going to be? Like two guitars, one guitar?
I think it's just going to be guitar, bass, and drums.
So power trio.
Nice. Yeah.
Wonderful.
To keep it, you know, we can get more money, you know.
Yeah.
And what, get the whole group into like one SUV. Yeah. So very cool. Is it going to be instrumental, or is someone going to do some vocals?
There will be vocals. I think the bass player will be doing vocals.
Okay.
Man, I'm stoked to hear this. Yeah.
Nice.
Not enough metal bands in Austin. Good ones anyway.
Is the
I don't know too much about the metal scene in Austin.
Haven't been impressed with it. The few times I've gone to sniff it out, like. You know, it's it was that way when I first moved to Austin. Like hip hop was like just non-existent, but that changed.
Yeah. And yeah, I got the impression that there's a little bit of hip hop stuff going on.
It's happening now, right around when it turned over into the 21st century. It started like underground hip hop was really blowing up in the rave culture in the late 90s, and so you started to see it, and it was like, oh, thank God, finally there's some hip hop shows, but. When I first moved to Austin, it was like, if there was one hip-hop show, it was in a really scary east side club that you've never heard of, and it's like, the shows weren't well integrated, or they weren't promoted to the college or anything like that. They were very much a separate affair, and a little bit frightening to go to those shows, but it's like, I grew up near Houston, so I loved hip-hop, like, that was metal and hip-hop, and, you know... I was equally into those things, so that has changed in Austin, and I'm hoping that there will be... More of, you know, an open-minded metal or, like, a couple of clubs that are, you know, I like metal. I like to see heavy bands. I like to see bands really go for it.
Yeah.
With the playing, too, or, like, some of the best drummers ever are those metal drummers. So
yeah,
I would like to see a scene happen. It seems like this town's big enough that it could support a metal community, you know, maybe... I know things have changed. Like I couldn't even say like maybe open a record store that's more geared towards metal because like how would that survive in this day and
age?
Well,
there is, and there has been the Encore Records.
Encore,
has been around for a long time.
Yeah, and they've hung on. Yeah. You know,
the one I would get the Houston Sound Exchange was like the metal place where I grew up in Beaumont. We would make road trips to there because they had a room like the metal room.
Oh, really?
And they were the first people to carry the Norwegian black metal stuff at the same time grunge was popping off. Norway was having its own renaissance with black metal, and Sound Exchange Houston was like the only place.
Church printings and all that, murders and stuff.
That was part of it, but there were also
salacious.
A handful of stellar albums that came out of that
scene. I really like Emperor. I'm not really a big black metal guy.
And The Dark Throne, the Unholy Trinity, they're three albums that, like their second, third, and fourth. Their first album was straight up death metal. Like, it sounded just like that band Death.
You're talking about, like, A Blaze in the Northern Sky?
Yeah, the ones I like, Blaze in the Northern Sky, Transylvanian Hunger, and Under a Funeral Moon. Like, those three are just killer. Mm-hmm. And then, man, there were other bands, too. Immortal, Pure Holocaust is, that is the fastest black metal ever got. Pure Holocaust is just killer. And, Norway became the symbol of quality for a minute. And then the church burning sort of, like, I don't know. The music got worse after the church burnings. Definitely.
Yeah.
Less interesting.
What's that documentary about?
There's been a few, but the one that most people saw was Until the Light
About
Takes
the Murder?
Us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's about the whole scene, yeah.
Well, yeah, but it kind of centers around the guy who committed the murder.
Yeah.
And the story of how that murder happened.
Yeah, it's like, that's why I like black metal. It's like when I have a black metal playlist, one artist has murdered another artist on the playlist.
Well, I think Necrozoid is going to try to avoid any of that kind of
drama. Yeah, no murder.
You guys aren't going to burn churches, really?
Well, back to what you were talking about with, like, things changing in Austin, I think that's one of the good things with Austin growing has been that all kinds of music seem to be, more happening. I know that with, with jazz and with creative improvised music, seems to me there's a lot. It could be that I just wasn't aware of it back in the day, but now it seems like there's a lot more interesting stuff going on. And if there's not a lot of metal bands, there's a lot of metal bands. More metal bands are playing here. It seems to me, anyhow.
Yeah.
Playing at the couple of venues that'll host them now that Emo's closed.
Right. Yeah. Or no, there's Emo's is just like a new place, right?
Isn't it? It's like a.
I haven't even been to that one yet.
Yeah, but the newer Emo's is more of a. They're big. Booking, they're not really necessarily as in touch with the local scene, in my opinion.
No.
Since they've changed up, they're more of like a
and it's too big for
a pass through club for
the old
big show
for medium sized bands.
Medium size, I guess.
Medium big bands. You know what I mean? Not actual size, but members.
And that place was the back room. I played there several times, and
I saw a lot of shows there.
I saw
Malmsteen there. I saw Watchtower there.
There have been, fucking Jane's Addiction played there on their first tour. It was,
Did you ever see Gwar there?
I saw the Bad Brains there. When I would play shows there, it's just, local bands. That room just, the friends you could get to come out were swallowed up by the size of that room.
It was so hard
to pack that room.
That's kind of like the North Door with... Although, I've played some shows where the North Door was pretty filled up. Stop Motion Orchestra CD release was a successful North Door show.
That's cool.
But if there's only 15 people there, it looks totally empty.
Because they fade into the background. There could even be 30 people in there, and it would look like nothing if they were standing in the certain places.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love that venue, man. Andrew's done
North Door. Oh yeah.
Those.
They get the sound.
Well, all the Montopolis shows were there.
I know you mentioned the Czars, but Andrew was in that Montopolis thing.
What else have I played at? North Door.
I guess I saw y'all at the Salvage Vanguard Theater. Were you playing in Montopolis?
Maybe. Let's see. Was that just me and Justin? I did a show there once. It was just me, Justin, and Steve Bernal for that.
I don't think Steve Bernal was there. I want to say it was like 5 or 6 people.
Yeah, maybe. I can't remember when we did a Salvage Vanguard. I think we did a preview of one of the silent films there, maybe we did just like some of the music from it, and then we did.
Is that what you saw? One of those silent film things where they did the?
I don't. I remember enjoying it, but I don't remember.
But it wasn't like you weren't watching a movie while it was happening.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Well,
I think I was playing that night, which means I was like in a different. I wasn't like totally.
The other thing I think we might have done. The classical or whatever the classical music showcase.
I think that's what it was.
Thing there, yeah, where we just played excerpts and we didn't have the film, but we played some of the.
It was like a kind of minimal, composed music.
Yeah.
I don't know what
that might have been. The man Man with a Movie Camera stuff. Because I think we did that showcase camera. Like 2 years. Yeah, well, it's a film.
Russian film.
From like the 20s, silent film. Yeah. Early 20s. Okay. Like 22 or 23.
It's really pioneering documentary.
Yeah, it's a documentary. Kind of very similar. I think it's sort of influenced Koyana Scotsi and those sorts of films where it's just kind of like. Or also, what's that? There's another composer out of New York. It's like people working, people going about their daily lives, film of that, and then, you know.
And you are the camera. It does a lot of that where it's like, it's sort of like you're watching thing and it'll hop on a car and film the car and then it'll, yeah, it's just, it for the time, it was amazing cinematography.
Yeah.
Kind of mind-blowing cause if you put it in context.
Yeah, so, and then you can go get that album if you want at montopolismusic.com. I'm on it, playing viola, so.
Awesome.
Church of the, have you been involved with the Church of the Friendly Ghost while you've been here? Or
I played a lot of stuff, Church of the Friendly Ghost events, and, you know, Hannah plays in Stop Motion Orchestra sometimes when she can. And we invited Thinking Plague, one of my favorite bands here, last year, and Church of the Friendly Ghost put that on. Last January, Thinking Plague came to Texas for the first time. And played a couple shows. They're pretty amazing.
Yeah, they get, Church of the Friendly Ghost always gets very interesting stuff. Hannah does a lot of programming for that, right? And
yeah.
She's got her finger, her ear to a bunch of, you know, interesting experimental stuff out there.
Yeah. So. Pretty much anything interesting you see in Austin, she is somehow involved.
Indeed.
So you got any gigs coming up or anything you want to plug? We usually run like a week or two behind, like for the release.
Yeah, do you have anything?
Maybe
March. You got any stuff by?
Yeah, I didn't even think to. We're planning
to put stuff up on the episode.
I think it's March 15th. Where Gibber and Twitch is playing. Gibber and Twitch is my tribute to the Cardiacs. And we're playing at Ugly Fest, which is at Cherrywood. I think it's March. It's on Wednesday during South By, and we play at like 6:45.
Okay.
2 weeks. So that probably on February 25th, there's No Means No tribute night. Well, there's a bunch of bands playing a few songs by No Means No. But I guess that's probably people will be hearing this after that.
Yeah.
And then Obnosticon is a band, like a hard rock band I play in, Mark Rogers' band, the guitarist in Foot Patrol.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We have a couple shows in March, but I don't know when they
What
are.
Flavor hard rock? What would you say?
It's like a mix. It's kind of got a 90s, like, Melvins type influence, but Mark is kind of like me. Like, he grew up listening to metal, so since I've been playing with them, I've been, like, kind of pushing it in a little bit more like thrash metal direction. So, cool. And then we have Carolyn Cremona, she was in Brown Hornet, or is in Brown Hornet, on vocals, and she does this like Telford thing that is just badass.
Insane.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's pretty awesome.
Cool.
Man, I'm excited to hear that. Does that band have an album?
We have an album. We have a new one coming out that's got some covers on it. We actually covered Judas Priest.
Priest song did you guys do?
We do Victim of Changes.
Wait, what album was that?
It's Sad Wings of Destiny.
Okay.
Second Judas Priest album.
Yeah.
Man,
that's really
I think that's got. Oh, it's also. We also do Black Sabbath Electric Funeral on there.
That's cool. what tuning are you guys doing for that band?
It's all standard tuning.
Standard? Okay.
Yeah. Cool. So you got. Couple of shows in March with those things. And
any other releases?
Any Stop Motion Orchestra?
Stop Motion Orchestra. Movies? I'm working on our second album. Leela just recorded the last of her vocals, and Sam sent me the last bass part. Sam Arnold is the bass player. And so now it's just a matter of me finalizing the mix and adding a few things. But I am doing a lot of stuff, so I don't know when it'll be done. I have the artwork ready, and I'm working on it when I have time, but I'm really excited about it too.
Yeah, cool, man.
So we opened with a musical improv What do you get? Do you guys want to play something for the outro music
real quick? Yeah, for sure. Let's make something
All right, wonderful. Well, this was really fun. Thanks for coming.
It was awesome to be on here with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this was great to have a guitar player. We do not have enough guitar players on here by far. We get a lot of string players.
Really?
A lot of singer-songwriters. Yeah. You would think in this town we would get a shitload of guitar
players. Yeah, I heard that there's like at least a handful.
You could throw out a new one. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in. This is episode 46 coming to a close. All right.